So she died in December. I think it was the first week of March. We drove down to Durham for the first time to meet with the district attorney. And we did understand the reason was that they were accusing Michael Peterson of murder. But I'm still at this point thinking it's a fall, because you really don't want to believe that your brother-in-law murdered your sister. It's not a very pleasant, happy, it's not something you want. In the course of this journey, one of the things I spent a lot of time was talking to medical examiners, reading about autopsies, watching an autopsy, and Deborah Radish told me that thyroid that was crushed, there's only two ways that happens that you see it in an autopsy. One is if you're in a car accident and your neck is hooked over a steering wheel, and the other way is it's a classic sign of strangulation. So at one point, Kathleen was even strangled. So Michael strangled her on top of beating her.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today, remotely, is
Laura Richards, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, former criminal behavioral analyst at New Scotland Yard, and author of the book Policing Domestic Violence.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
Well, we're deep into our analysis of the Netflix original series, The Staircase, and right now we're discussing Michael Peterson's behavior in the early morning hours of December 9th, 2001. That's the morning his wife, Kathleen, was found dead. So let's get back into the case.
Yep.
Laura, if he had discovered her with all this blood everywhere and she's still breathing, why is complete upper body not covered in her blood? Why aren't his knees covered in her blood? Why isn't he down there on the floor with her trying to help her? And you could tell there's movement when he calls 911. There's movement. He's like walking over to sort of like count the steps or something when she asks him, you know, how many steps did she fall down? He's like, huh? How many steps did she fall down? What? You know, and he has to, and he just blows her off. I don't know. It's 15, 20. I don't know. You know, because again, he wasn't doing what somebody who he claims to be would do in that situation, which is help her. If she's breathing and she's injured, you're going upstairs to get towels rather than grabbing a dish towel or some napkins to stop the flow of blood.
Or you're not talking to her like, Kathleen, wake up, wake up. I mean, there was none of that.
Right.
Behaviorally, they are red flags, as we know. And so when people say we're taking one side or the other, we haven't even really got into The Staircase as a documentary. We're just at the very start of it. And there's no side to take other than Jim and I highlighting where our red flags are of behavior. And there are numerous red flags here. In theory, be taking his shoes and socks off at a time when every second counts, that your loved one is dying in front of you and every second counts. Yeah. And that's when you should be doing everything possible. He was an ex-Marine. He would have known CPR, I would have thought.
Michael Peterson said he took his shoes and socks off because it was slippery. Unless you're wearing flat-soled leather shoes, usually shoes actually give you better traction than your bare feet. I mean, people slip all the time in the showers, and because your feet don't necessarily grip on a wet, slippery floor, but shoes actually generally help give you more traction. So I'm not buying that as a reason.
Yeah. And why would you want your wife's blood on your feet? I mean, that's, I don't even.
His life wasn't in danger. So it wasn't that he had an immediate threat and there's a commotion going on and he puts the phone down. But the other issue, Jim, is where did Todd come from? Did he make the phone call to Todd and Todd comes back to the house with his friend, Ben, who's very drunk, who became a problem for the paramedics and the police? You know, he wasn't living at the house at the time. So where did he come from and how long was he there for?
And why would he show up after 2 a.m.? Unless Michael called him.
Well, that's the question. You didn't even know that from The Staircase. That's come through from numerous other sources. And he was the one saying that she was drunk. But she also had these defensive wounds on her hands and wrists and the pine needles in her hand and hair. I do think that That's interesting. And I wondered whether the Christmas tree was up at that time, you know, and if it's a real Christmas tree, I know having had a lot of them myself that shed, you know, is that where the pine needles came from? And Hare, is she fighting somebody? She's got these defensive wounds and she's got blood on the bottom of her feet. And those things to me imply some form of struggle with the strangulation aspect.
Yeah, they definitely look like that to me as well. I don't know.
So the still breathing, I was just watching today that the 911 operator on the stand, and she says in that testimony that she asked him if she was still breathing. And so that's where that came from. But that's not
but that's not true.
That's not, I know. So that is what's also so confusing. Like, why would she say that? But when we hear the call, unless we're hearing an edited call, unless we actually don't have the entire thing, he brings that up just out of the blue. He, you know, she doesn't prompt that. So why would she say that on the stand? I don't understand that. But anyway.
Well, because if she didn't say it and she testified about it on the stand, it was because she was asked a question she didn't anticipate. And she, her memory wasn't great. I don't know how many years later it was. It was quite a time.
Yeah. I thought she was reading a transcript. I don't know. It looked like she was looking down and reading a transcript, but I don't know. But that's something that everybody gets very confused about. And the other thing is, last time we were recording, I was saying that, gosh, I can't imagine how this could have been a fall with this kind of blood spray. But one of our listeners, Liz, thank you very much, just sent me a photo of a story of an elderly woman who fell down a stairs, and the blood spray is immense. I mean, it's just all over the place. So I don't know what to think. I don't know what to think.
All right. When you say she fell down a stair, did she fall down a staircase or did she fall down one or two steps?
It was an elderly woman who, you know, they had one of those chair lifts that go
down a chairlift. Yeah, yeah. And there was one in this stairwell as well.
Yeah. And it got stuck and she fell. I'm trying to scan through how many things she fell down. But at first they thought she would have been attacked by a machete, which is exactly what it looks like. But no, she actually fell. And I guess, as Dr. Lee says, expectorated, aspirated her blood all over the walls. So I would never have thought that. But anyway.
It's possible. We need to know what the circumstances of that fall were. And did she have seven separate lacerations? Did she have scratches on her face? Right. Did she have a broken left thyroid cartilage? Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of things that that may differentiate these cases. But as I said, spray, small, numerous dotted patterns of blood on the wall can come from coughing or sneezing blood out. So it's just what's the source of that blood that I would like to know. So did this woman actually aspirate blood and then cough it out? Or did she also fill her mouth with blood somehow and then just cough or blow it out?
Right.
Those are details that would tell us whether this is the same or different.
Yeah.
Mm. And there was another medical examiner who attended the scene, Dr. Snell, who I believe was Dr. Radish's boss at the time, the chief medical examiner. And he apparently turned to Art Holland, the detective, and said, if it's not a fall, it was a rod-like instrument. You should be looking for something like that. He said that at the scene. And then, of course, we know what transpires is this whole issue of the blowpoke, which we will come on to. But where that fits in just with, there was a very interesting scene for me in the staircase where the defense are talking at the round table and Tom is basically saying, well, there are seven lacerations or seven separate blows, according to Deborah Radish, the forensic pathologist. Someone has to explain that, at least for the medical. And David Rudolph says to Michael Peterson, yes, we need a defense. We need to explain this. And Michael Peterson then says, I agree, we need a defense, if only to answer the questions Radish raises and fill in the blanks. So David Roof says, well, the truth is the jury will trip on, you know, how do you get these lacerations in these locations from falling down the stairs? And Michael Peterson turns around and says, the only thing you have to prove was that it wasn't that damn blowpoke.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the bloody blowpoke. I know that. And it just struck me as an odd thing to say.
Right.
The fact he said it so compellingly, you know, and I just felt, well, he knows because he knows what went on. And he knows it's not the blowpoke.
Right. And I agree. I absolutely 100% believe that the injuries on Kathleen's head were not caused by a blowpoke. I do not believe that a blowpoke, unless it's some wrought iron one that is from, you know, 200 years ago, that was, you know, thick-walled wrought iron that would not bend and break when smacking against somebody's skull, as did the blowpoke that the sister gave Kathleen. It broke when during the testing of smacking it against something.
Right.
So I know that they're generally much more flimsy than other fireplace implements. And there's just, I do not believe that you would have that kind of injury coming from a blowpoke. So I think it was a mistake for the prosecution to use that and to rely on that, especially since they did not have this weapon. And I do believe that they could have very easily argued that the steps became a weapon, not because she fell on them, but she was forced onto them.
I'll be honest with you, I do very, very thorough searches. We searched the entire premises of that house very thoroughly on two different occasions.
Well, you don't always have the luxury of finding the murder weapon in every case, just like in a lot of cases you don't have the luxury of having DNA.
Well, Michael Peterson actually bought three new blowpokes throughout the trial, which I think is a very bizarre thing to do, but in another sense, yeah, he did. And he admitted to that. He was questioned about it by beyond reasonable doubt because a number of people had written in to say he actually was buying blowpokes. And, you know, I believe that he was buying them because he was confident that a blowpoke had nothing to do with it. But it just struck me as a very odd scene where, you know, and he's interrupted when he says, well, it wasn't the bloody blowpoke, I know that. And then he's interrupted, right. And I wanted to know what the next thing was he was going to say.
Right. Well, here's the other thing, Laura. Who's to say that that blowpoke that was found wasn't purchased by Michael Peterson? Because obviously it was found late in the game, and it was in the house where he was living, and it was in a place that he had access to. So why do we know that that is some original piece of evidence when it could very well have been something staged later? I mean, just the fact that it was dirty and had cobwebs, I mean, that could happen in a matter of days, not necessarily over the course of, you know, many years.
Yeah, I agree. And the chain of custody, I mean, I found it odd that the defense team were called rather than the police to secure the evidence.
I was wondering too. Like, why? Yeah, I was wondering that.
Well, they were doing it to protect their asses. I mean, I pretty much guarantee that if they had found Michael Peterson's or Kathleen's DNA on that blowpoke, they would have just hidden it.
Well, that's what he says. He says that his son kind of intimated that, like, Dad, should we chuck this into the lake or something?
And he's like, no, don't do that. Because guess what? This is what Michael Peterson leaked out when he said that, Laura. He knows that nobody other than him could have killed Kathleen. Because if somebody came in and hit Kathleen over the head with a blowpoke, that could be that blowpoke. In other words, he has to know with certainty that nobody else could have taken the blowpoke, hit her over the head, and left with it. Right?
Yeah.
And how does he know that? Why does he have such a level of confidence in that? It's just another example of leakage by somebody who doesn't realize how much he's giving away by his behavior and statements.
We have so much more to talk about.
I know. Well, that's good.
We haven't even got to Germany. We talked about Liz Ratliff, but we'll save that for next time.
So I hope our listeners can see that, at least for me, I go back and forth. I am, talk about being bi. I am bi in this case. I am going back and forth. I don't know what to think. It's so complicated.
Well, can we talk about that, by the way?
Yes.
Because I understand some listeners thought that we were biased against bisexual people. Yeah. That couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
Bisexuality, I have studied sexuality with the FBI over the course of my career. And bisexuality is clearly on the spectrum of normal sexuality. I mean, there are some people that feel 100% heterosexual and 100% homosexual, and there are people in varying degrees in between. And that's a normal spectrum of human behavior. And so there's no way that I judge it, or Laura judges it, or Lisa judges it. It's whether or not Kathleen knew about it, and whether or not she approved of it, and whether or not Michael was hiding it, and whether or not it was a potential trigger for the events that unfolded that night. That's what we're considering. We're not judging at all somebody's sexuality, because that's absolutely not what we do.
Right.
Exactly. And the reason it was brought in the first place was because David Rudolph stated they were the perfect couple. They were soulmates. They were this fantastic union and partnership. And he painted this picture by saying that if it were that, how did it get to this bloody crime scene? And he was trying to show that there was no way that it could get to Michael Peterson killing her. Mm-hmm. And the minute he opened, you know, with his opening statements, went down that track, it gave the prosecution the chance to paint a different side to the story, that they weren't this perfect, as indeed no couple is a perfect couple. But what they showed was actually, no, there were some other things that were going on in the relationship that may well point to triggers and motive. And so that's why we brought it up, based on what Kathleen Peterson was it likely that she knew? Would she have been happy? And, you know, it was an open relationship, and therefore she was happy for him to see male sex workers while she was at work. Or would she have been happy if he was just cheating on her with another woman or another man? And we know that she wouldn't have been, given her previous relationship where she was cheated on, and that was a deal breaker. And that's why we started talking about it.
Right.
In terms of the victimology and her response. But Michael Peterson does say in one breath that she did know about it. But of course, when we see him being interviewed about the male sex worker, he doesn't deny it straight out. He asks what was said.
Right, exactly. And that's incredibly important, because what he did was he wanted to find out what they knew before he said what happened. And that is the sign of somebody who's hiding the truth, somebody who's not being fully forthcoming, somebody who's lying.
Well, this is a bigger conversation we're going to get to in another episode. You know, marriages are complex, and what partners know, don't know, acknowledge, don't, I mean, this is a huge subject. So I just want to tell our listeners, without a doubt, I would never be on a podcast with anyone who was discriminating against anyone for their sexuality. Jim and Laura would never do that.
I would neither.
I would never do that. I'm a bisexual person, so I would never do that. I'm telling you that right now. And I want to get past this, and I want it, because we're going to talk about this in depth. And I am very upset at how the subject was used in the documentary. It is absolutely disgusting to me how it was used and by the prosecution. But regardless of that, you know, it doesn't mean that he's innocent or guilty, but it's just another facet of this relationship. But anyway, so there you go.
Hold on. I still struggle with you saying you're upset about how it's used by the prosecution, when their job is to show, present the facts of what was going on, present their
case. I have a problem with an assistant DA who says this is filthy, that this is that is so condemning of this, and I feel perfect. That's how I feel personally. There's a lot of things that you could say. Did this trigger homicidal rage of his outing? We can talk about that, but to deliberately, I feel, pandled to a jury about how this is filthy.
Right.
About, well, you know, I don't.
I think what you're seeing is a very prim and proper Southern prosecutor who knows what the makeup of the jury is,
right,
and was playing towards them. And I get that. I mean, it happens all the time. And it really doesn't have any place, because in this case, that is playing on a bias, as opposed to the fact, though, that they used it is one thing. I think it's completely legitimate, and I agree with Laura. However, if they let their moral judgment influence it and tried to use morality to dirty the defendant, so that they could convince the jurors that's not the proper way to use it. So I do see both sides of this issue. And I know that in this case, the way the female prosecutor described it was very moralistic.
And not only in front of the jury, but, you know, the documentarians have her, you know, by herself talking about it. So, and that's fine. I you know, I don't want to judge this woman. Rest in peace. You know, she's recently deceased, but that I bumped on that, and I'm a person, and that's my reaction. And, you know, maybe it's a flaw in me, but that's what I.
No, don't say that. We didn't say it's a flaw in you, but I can disagree with you about whether or not it should have been used. Okay. And also agree with you about the moral judgment of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's how it's colored. That's what I was trying to understand from Lisa. And I, what the reaction that I'm hearing is why exactly? Because when we talked about it, Jim, we were talking about it as a fact and why it's important about baseline and lying and behavior and what's accepted in one partnership, you know, as a couple. It can obviously be different in a different couple, but it was more about the fact that saying that he is bisexual. But I, yeah, the way it's coloured and the way it may be used on a morality point to colour somebody, then, you know, that's a different aspect to it.
Sure.
But Freida Black, you know, she makes some very interesting statements that I would like to like us to kind of go through as well, of things like, you know, lightning doesn't strike twice. She's very black and white in the things that she says at times. Mm-hmm. So I think there's going to be other pickups of just the way things are presented as we go through the staircase for us to comment on. But when we're doing our analysis, we do go for the facts and the evidence.
Absolutely.
And Rudolph did open the door on that one. If you're going to say someone's a perfect, you know, partnership and relationship, then you've got to show evidence to that point. If there's contrary evidence that says otherwise, you've opened the door for the other side.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right.
All right. Well, that gives us a lot to talk about in the upcoming Real Crime Profile episodes about the Netflix original series, The Staircase. Thanks to our listeners, and our listeners might be happy to hear a few recommendations. Laura, do you have anything?
I do. I have two. I have one, which is for a BBC show called The Bodyguard, which is currently airing on BBC One. And it's a great drama series. It's six parts. It's with Keely Hawes, and it's about the Home Secretary and a terrorism plot. And I think it's very good. There's lots of twists and turns. So it's definitely worth watching. And one of my friends and colleagues is the police advisor on it, someone called David Zinzan, who I worked with on a serial rape case. He was a tremendous senior investigating officer and leader, and he's doing some great work on that show, The Bodyguard. And the second thing I just wanted to mention was some of the training events that I'm running in London. I have a masterclass, a homicide prevention masterclass next week on how to prevent stalking and murder in slow motion, and that's on September the 18th. And I have a domestic abuse, stalking and harassment, and unabased violence risk model masterclass session on September 20th and a train the trainer on the 21st. And then my two classes the following week are preventing murder in slow motion on the 26th of September, where I talk very much about coercively controlling behavior and stalking, lots of case studies to help learners identify behaviors, and then a coercive control full-day masterclass on September 27th.
Oh my God, wow. I'm exhausted just hearing that.
I know, it's a lot, but we have to raise awareness and train professionals, and it's the only way we get better at what we do. Because the other thing, you know, that I've just released recently is that 80% of stalkers are not being charged currently in the UK. And this is very concerning, and it all goes back to training of identifying behaviors. So the training is vital. And if people are interested in coming, you can go on the Dash website, or you can email my training coordinator, jenny@laurarichards.co.uk. Because the idea is to get as many people on the course and educated, as they are the lifelines for victims. Really important stuff.
Yeah. And I'll be going to Michigan State to speak on a panel about the Nassar case. Francie Hakes will be there with me, and we're going to be doing that on Friday, this coming Friday.
The 21st. Will there be any links to it, or will you be posting anything about it?
I will, I'm sure. I think it's a public forum. So it'll be Friday the 21st in Michigan and at Michigan State. And it's going to be talking about how to identify nice guy acquaintance, pillar of the community offenders. And I'll be discussing both the Nassar case and the Sandusky case, as well as the thousands of other cases that relate to it. So I think that's an important thing also to educate the public and to sort of begin this open dialogue about how these types of offenders are so insidious.
Absolutely. It sounds fascinating. Well, I wish you luck with that. And I look forward to seeing your tweets on it and hearing how it went.
Well, I'm not doing anything nearly as important, but I am still running in the 5K on September 23rd for CASA. My son and I are running. And thank you to the listeners who've not already have given to me, but also who've told me that they've Googled CASA in their neck of the woods and have given their local CASAs. So thank you so much for that.
That's great. But you'll also be casting my episode very shortly in a couple of weeks Criminal Minds, which is episode 1409. And it's going to be called Broken Wings. And it's going to be directed by Aisha Tyler.
That's right.
I'm so excited about working with her.
I was listening to a podcast that she did with Tim Ferriss. And she is, favorite podcaster, aside from Bob Raff and Us and, you know, everybody else. But yeah, she did a fantastic interview with him that's just dropped. And I would highly recommend people listen to it. He asks fantastic questions, but wow, she's incredible. She's done so many things. She's like a superhero.
She is.
Yeah, she is.
She and I went to Santa Fe together a few months ago because her film got into the Santa Fe Film Festival and I was on the panel at Santa Fe Film. So we went and hung out and it was so fun to get to know her like that. And I hope maybe, Jim, we can encourage her to come on our podcast and talk about things that are important for her. But she is such a doll. And yeah, you're right. She is a Shiro Laura.
She is. She's incredible.
But I do want to also mention that I saw the movie Peppermint and I have to say that Jennifer Garner definitely prepared extremely well. She got into amazing shape for this, and she was so focused as an actress. I thought she did an amazing job. You know, I do think that a couple of the scenes, the courtroom scene, could have been a little more dramatically accurate. But I want to shout out to my friend Mario Cortez, who's on LAPD SWAT, who was actually the tech advisor on the film, and I heard his voice before I even saw him on the screen, and he was on the screen, and he's the only guy who looked like a real cop, and he sounded like a real cop, and he acted like a real cop. It was so great to see him. I was surprised, but it was so great to see him on the screen. So shout out to Mario Cortez, and it's a great movie.
That's so funny. Usually real cops are not good at playing real cops. That's what's been in my experience, Jim. So.
Well, he's done a lot of undercover work, so I think he does a great job being able to act. You know, that's a major component of being undercover. And I reiterate, by the next time we're on the air, I will definitely have seen A Simple Favor because it's coming out today and I'm definitely going to go see it right away.
Thank you very much to all of our listeners. Please keep your messages coming on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter. And thank you for your feedback saying that you're enjoying what we do. We really appreciate it. So this is Real Crime Profiles signing off. If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107
Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.